Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston tells us about some ideas he has about what might be lurking in Donald Trump's tax returns. Then, on the eve of Barack Obama's historic trip to the island nation, we'll speak with Julia Swag, author of Cuba, What Everyone Needs to Know, about the reality of the regime's human and civil rights situation. It tends to get exaggerated in our media, I have to say, and what the future might hold after the Castro era comes to an end. Finally, we'll be joined by Washington Monthly web editor Martin Longman. Martin is also known as the blogger Boo Man, about the Obama administration's choice of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. Many on the left are unhappy with the pick, but Longman thinks they're not looking at the big picture, and I tend to agree. But first, we had some more primary contests this week. Little Marco Rubio lost his seat on the clown car. You know, I never agreed with the conventional wisdom that he'd be a formidable candidate in the general election. We heard lots of talk about him being robotic and rehearsed. There was that moment that he repeated himself again and again. But I figured he wasn't ready for prime time. I mean, generally, but when McKay Coppins reported for BuzzFeed that he's prone to debilitating bouts of anxiety, I thought, oh God, that's not going to be good. It's not a good trait for a president, and it's certainly not great for a general election candidate because, you know what, the tension, the pressure is kind of high. Meanwhile, conservatives continue to plot some sort of convention coup d'etat to deprive Donald Trump of the nomination. You know, given the Republican base's contempt for the establishment right now, I'm pretty sure that if they go this route, they would tear their party apart. And that means they're really stuck between a rock and a hard place. If they do knock off Trump, let's keep in mind that they get smarmy, reactionary Ted Cruz, whose own dog basically doesn't like him. Donald Trump hinted that there might be riots at the convention if they were to go through with their scheme, I guess we should call it. And speaking of riots, I dug into the Democratic exit polls for this past Tuesday's contests. Hillary Clinton exceeded expectations on Tuesday by sweeping all five states. And looking at exit polls conducted during the March 1st Super Tuesday primaries. And here's what I found. I found that voters this week were about 20% more likely to name electability as their top attribute for a candidate. And two-thirds of them said that Hillary Clinton was a better bet to defeat Donald Trump. The ABC's exit polls asked specifically about Trump. And don't send me hate mail. I'm just reporting what the polls found. I know lots of Bernie supporters think he's the stronger general election candidate, the better bet to beat Trump. But this is what the primary voters were telling pollsters. So I also found that the largest share of voters saying that electability was their top trait for a candidate was in Florida, where Hillary Clinton won in a blowout. And the highest share of voters who said Sanders would be the better bet to beat Trump was in Missouri. It was about 40%. And in Missouri, the two basically battled to a tie. And so here's my theory. On the Friday before the primaries, Trump canceled his event in Chicago, and the media replayed scenes of supporters skirmishing with protesters over and over again. Trump lied. He said that the police advised him to cancel the rally. The police said, no, we never said anything like that. Really, he just wanted to dominate the coverage for the following 3 days leading up to the primaries. And he did that very, very successfully. So we were treated to 3 days of basically wall-to-wall coverage of protesters being pepper sprayed, punched in the face, whatever. It made for great TV, so all of the rest of his events were kind of treated like breaking news stories. You'd see Fox and CNBC, CNN and MSNBC breaking away from the regular coverage to cover just some Trump campaign event. And that saturation coverage might have helped him, but I think it also helped Hillary. I think that there were some Democratic primary voters who watched the violence and saw the increasingly authoritarian tone of Trump's campaign in dealing with it, right? He was yelling at his supporters to get him out of here, get him out of the room, telling them that he'd pay for their legal expenses if they hurt a protester. He threatened to send his supporters to disrupt Bernie Sanders' events. And I think some of those primary voters, those Democratic voters, who might have been inspired by Bernie Sanders' campaign, they decided it wasn't worth the risk. They thought the stakes are just too high. And when you're facing a candidate who's a quasi-fascist, proto-fascist, what have you, you have to go with a safer bet. And I think it might have pushed Hillary over the top on Tuesday. Anyway, it's a theory, and the polling data tends to support it. I would always offer a grain of salt when using exit polls. They're not perfect. But I wrote about this at thenation.com. Listeners can check it out. The piece is titled, "Did the Chaos and Violence at Trump's Rallies Push Clinton Over the Top on Tuesday?" Give it a read. And we'll take a quick break and then be right back in a moment with David K. Johnston.
Dear, I fear we're facing a problem. You love me no longer, I know. And maybe there is nothing that I can do to make you do.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by David K. Johnston. David is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who has forgotten more about our tax system and how it favors the uber-wealthy than most of us will ever know. All of his books are must-reads. He writes all over the place. David, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Well, thank you for having me, Josh.
Now, one of the most delicious moments of the crazy 2016 campaign was Mittens Romney attacking Donald Trump for withholding his taxes. And we all remember that Mitt Romney kept his taxes under wraps until the very last moment. And Mitt also predicting that they contained some bombshells. David, do you remember when Mitt Romney paid excess taxes in 2012? He sent the IRS a bigger check than he had to so that his effective tax rate would be over 10 or 11%.
Yes. Romney, in the initial filing, the one we saw, didn't take all of the deductions that he was entitled to so that he would show a higher tax return. So we only saw 2 years of Mitt's tax returns, and I'm sure that after the election he amended the other return to take all the deductions that he was entitled to, and there's nothing wrong with doing that. But here's the key thing. He wouldn't release, and I pressed this as did some other people, the returns from the years when he was the sole owner, not the manager, the sole owner of Bain Capital Management, because Congress has rules that allow private equity managers to live tax-free. And I'm certain when Harry Reid said on the floor of the Senate that, you know, he didn't pay taxes for 10 years, that he was on the money and probably had some knowledge to this, because a number of people would know about Romney's tax returns or around Romney.
Right.
And it would make no sense for him to pay taxes during those years because he can borrow against his wealth and live on the borrowed money.
Well, I just want to stress, though, that
it's important that Trump isn't releasing his returns from the, and probably for the same reason, I don't think Trump pays taxes.
Right, right. And it just amazes me that Romney, and I think that it's obvious that he did this, went back and amended those returns so that he could get that extra money that he got, that he paid just for appearance's sake. Anyway, let's move on to Trump. You wrote a column for the National Memo. Folks, David writes everywhere. I think of myself as being kind of prolific, but this guy's amazing. Anyway, he wrote a column titled 9 Key Points About Trump's Income Taxes and Many More Questions. Listeners can Google that. Trump says he can't release his taxes because he's in the midst of an audit. You write that Trump's excuse is nonsense. Can you explain that?
Well, sure. Once you've turned your tax return over to the IRS, releasing it doesn't change anything. You've signed it under penalty of perjury and given it to the IRS. And I was on Lawrence O'Donnell with Mark Everson, who was George W. Bush's IRS commissioner. He said the same thing. There's no reason not to release it. More importantly, there's no reason for Trump not to release the returns prior to the years currently under audit, which Trump has suggested without saying so, or 2012, 13, and 14. So why not give us the 2011, 10, 9, 8? And the reason for that is there's a special rule Congress put in place in the 90s that if Donald owns as much real estate as he says he does, because we don't know his ownership stakes and how they're organized, but if he owns as many buildings as he says, then in all likelihood, he pays zero federal income taxes. And I did a column for USA Today that pointed out that if he was able to defer what he said was his salary for 1 year from The Apprentice, the tax would have been $23 million. And after 20 years, he would pay the $23 million to the government and pocket $130 million. That is, for people like Donald Trump and Mitt Romney, the income tax is a source of wealth. The rest of us are burdened by it. They get rich off it.
And I just want to make sure that people understand what you're saying. They defer their taxes, millions and millions and millions of dollars, and then they don't have to pay interest on those deferred taxes. So effectively, if, for example, you were to invest that in whatever and get a 5% return, you would pocket the 5% return, pay back the principal with no interest. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So it's effectively a zero interest loan. And in the example I gave about Trump, Trump claimed he got $65 million to The Apprentice, which anybody who knows anything about television knows is absurd. And NBC made the extraordinary action of publicly saying it was absurd. But let's assume he made $65 million. The federal income tax that year would have been about $23 million. Trump says he's a world-class investor, so let's assume he nets 10% a year. At the end of 20 years, he could then pay the $23 million, which has been eroded by inflation, but it's still $23 million nominal dollars, and he would pocket gains from investing that money of $130 million. And this is why the super rich are getting super richer, in large part, is the tax system takes from you and me and gives to them.
And this is such an important point. It's not just that these people aren't paying taxes, it's that they're profiting from the tax system.
That's right.
David, do you think it's likely that he's been audited for the past 12 years? Should we believe that?
Well, we have no way of knowing, but remember that Trump has many entities. So if any entity, you know, partnership, corporation, if any of those got audited, Trump would, of course, claim that he was being audited. If you've got 50 or 100 entities, sure, it's possible. And by the way, if you get audited year after year after year by the by the IRS, it suggests that they are finding serious problems, and that's why they keep coming back at you. Because normally they look at you, they'll look at you for related years if your tax return has things that link over a couple of years, and then they go on to somebody else.
And the most comical thing in this entire election season is probably Trump suggesting that he is being persecuted for his Christianity. That is hilarious.
Well, I mean, we all know that Donald Trump is one of the most pious people in America, and to compare any of us to his level of piety, and of course, you know, with the birther, with the Kenyan-born Muslim terrorist in the White House, of course, Mr. Trump is being persecuted for being such a pious man, especially one who is deeply respectful of his marital vows.
I mean, he really knows his audience to even try that one. So you say that the potential bombshell is that he may well report negative income. And you mentioned more than one way that this might be happening. So let's talk about the other ways that he might be getting his the bottom line on his 1040 down to a negative number.
Well, the most important way is depreciation of real estate. There's if most Americans can only deduct $25,000 of depreciation. So if you have a job to pay $75,000 and you're a landlord on the side, even if you have $100,000 of depreciation, you can only take $25,000 to offset your paycheck. But this special rule says if you're a full-time real estate person, and by the way, full-time in this case is 15 hours a week, then you can take unlimited real estate deductions. That is overwhelmingly the most likely way that he's done it.
Yeah, you gave another example about how he's probably writing off his luxurious lifestyle as a business expense.
You're not allowed to take personal expenses on your against your taxes. Congress defines what's a deductible expense. What Trump almost certainly does is his jet, his 757 jet, is owned by one of his businesses. He probably has a letter from his security advisor that says that it's not safe for him to travel commercially because he might be kidnapped or attacked. That allows him to use the jet for personal use and pay nothing for it, except the taxes on the value. And the way Congress values it, you would the value they give is virtually nothing. Okay, you pay virtually nothing. The taxes on a round trip flight to Paris would come to less than $900, even though you're flying in your own personal 757 jet. And even those taxes, he can arrange for his companies to pay him and gross them up. He undoubtedly doesn't go anywhere without it being a business expense. I'm sure that he argues that Mar-a-Lago, because it's a private club and has a golf course, that's a business expense, and he deducts that. So in all likelihood, his whole lifestyle is funded off of that. And, of course, you know, the Trump ties that he wears, the vendor gives him ties because, after all, they want him only to wear Donald Trump ties made, by the way, made in China. Yes, I'm sure that he is able to charge a lot of his lifestyle to the tax system.
And to the tax system means to me and to you, right?
Oh, I mean, it means you and I are subsidizing.
We're subsidizing
him.
This rich guy.
That's
yeah,
right.
It's amazing. Now, I know you wrote the piece a little while ago. You talked about some stuff that his taxes might reveal aside from tax avoidance strategies. And you mentioned the dispute about how much pay he's getting from The Apprentice. But what might they tell us about his charitable giving and his mob connections, potential mob
right.
connections?
Well, not potential. I mean, Donald has long, deep mob connections. One of the charges that sent fat Tony Salerno, the number one mobster in America, to prison involved doing business with Donald Trump. And Trump wasn't forced into doing this. In fact, it cost him more money to do business with the mob. Trump Tower is a concrete building, not a steel girder high-rise building. If we had Trump's tax returns, we'd have the detailed knowledge of the entities, the partnerships and corporations and trusts that he's dealing with. And from there, public disclosure records could lead us to other people who are involved in these businesses, and we would see whether he's continuing to be involved with the mafia. We know that he's, until very recently, been very involved with a Russian mobster, and scam artist. And I'm confident that if we had his full tax returns, we would find a lot about Donald's connections to people who are criminals or behave in atrocious ways. We would also learn how much depreciation he's getting, which would tell us what's the real value of his share in the buildings that have his name on them. Some of the buildings with Trump's name on them, he doesn't own. He simply gets a fee for putting his name on them. Others, he does have an ownership role in. And knowing Donald, as I've had for 27 years, I'm sure that he orchestrates these deals to make sure that he pays little or no tax wherever he can. Also, if you have zero income on your tax return or negative income, giving to charity has no value to you. Well, Trump has not donated a penny to the Donald J. Trump Foundation since 2006. And most of the money in the foundation didn't come from him. It came from vendors and business partners, the World Wrestling Federation, the guy who makes the ties, people like that, which suggests that their donations are really a form of a kickback, a legal form of kickback, but nonetheless a kickback. And if Trump has zero income, why would he give anything to charity since he's a heavily tax-motivated guy, as most people in real estate are? Back when Donald claimed to be worth in 1993 billion dollars but couldn't pay his bills, I got his personal net worth statement that showed he had a negative net worth of hundreds of millions of dollars. And two reporters working under me and I called charities all over New York trying to find gifts by Donald Trump, who got an allowance from his bankers, I think it was $400,000 a year, to give to charities. And we couldn't find anything of any consequence. I mean, he bought a table at some dinner for the New York Police Athletic League sort of things. They were just minor. No indication whatsoever of any charitable intent by Donald, who, of course, tells us all he's an ardent philanthropist.
Yeah, this guy's such a con artist.
It rates right up there with, you know, he's a Christian. You know, and remember, right. Donald does things for show. You know, he actually went to church the other day, so that, to use his language, he could have his cracker and hear from 2 Corinthians.
Yeah, the 2 Corinthians. So, and I should point out that also those donations to the wounded warrior groups, the veterans groups, went directly to his foundation. And there have been some questions about where that money is going and whether it's all going to be dispersed to groups that are actually working to help veterans.
And one of the groups that he said had hundreds of thousands of members that he went and had an event with in Long Beach turns out to be run by a single guy who appears to be a con artist.
Yeah, and that group popped up the day before that event or something like that, and it has no footprint anywhere except for that event that he held.
That's right.
David, before I let you go, I want to ask you to take a look at the big picture. 4 years ago, we had a national discussion about how the uber wealthy make money from the tax system in the context of Mitt Romney. Now we're talking about Trump. Maybe we'll talk about it in the context of the Clintons. But what is the larger dynamic that people need to understand about this?
Well, they need to pay attention to how the system really works. I mean, unfortunately, most of the people you see on TV and politicians, whatever they tell you about the tax system is only occasionally and incidentally related to reality. And the serious tax policy people just aren't being listened to. The tax system in this country is damaging the country, but the solution is not lower tax rates. That's just more giveaways for people at the top. The solution is we need an entirely new federal tax code, and I'm actually writing the statutory language, even though I'm not a lawyer. I do teach at law school, but I'm not a lawyer. The statutory language and a narrative book to explain to people that we know we have in America a great federal tax system for 1960. We live in a totally different economy where wealth and the flows of capital are very different than they were in 1960. So just as we got a new tax system to found this country, remember, we live in the Second American Republic, and we created the Constitution so we could tax ourselves, and we ran the government mostly with tariffs when we were a rural society with little need for government. When we became an industrial society with need for a lot more government, we got the income tax, the corporate income tax, the gift tax, the estate tax. We're now moving from a industrial society to a digital society. That requires a new tax system. And history shows that if you don't modify your tax system to keep up with economic changes, you eventually destroy your society. So that's what we need to be doing, is we need to understand that we have to have a new tax system and to stop talking about, oh, the rich don't have enough, we need to lower their taxes or we won't have jobs. No, that will actually just destroy more jobs.
David K. Johnson, I'm really looking forward to that book. I believe we are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking to us today.
Delighted to be with you.
Folks, I mentioned that all of David's books are great, but if you want to understand how corrupt the tax code is, you must read Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else. It's not his newest book, but it will make your blood boil. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be right back.
Mesdames et messieurs, s'il vous plaît, soyez prêts pour Aaron Chupa et Albatraos. C'est parti!
Welcome back to the show. I'm joined now by Julia Zweig. Julia is an expert on Latin American politics. She's a senior research fellow at the University of Texas, Austin. Julia, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
I'm very happy to be with you. Thanks for having me.
This week, the Obama administration announced that it was relaxing restrictions on Americans traveling to Cuba and on trade between the U.S. and the island nation a few days in advance of what's being billed as a historic visit. Now, I traveled to Cuba once many years ago. I also visited the former East of Germany. And while they both had communist regimes, both of them suppressed dissent, I found the two countries drastically different. The people in East Germany seemed broken. They seemed outwardly frightened. In Cuba, they didn't seem to have that same fear of talking to us, even though we had a tour guide, quote-unquote tour guide, who was clearly a member of the state's intelligence. So I don't want to be Pollyannish about the regime, and at the same time, I think our media does tend to exaggerate the repressive nature of leftist governments in general in Latin America. So can you give us a balanced, reality-based view of the human and civil rights situation in Cuba today and how it has changed, if it has changed?
Sure. That's a large question, but I'll do my best. I should tell your listeners that I first visited Cuba in 1984, as a college student, and I would say that the arc of change on those fronts is pretty dramatic. I also was staffed a human rights delegation into Cuba's prisons in the late 1980s when there were many, many political prisoners, when dissent was punished and stifled. I have been happily surprised that, especially I would say in the last decade, Cuba has become is becoming a more open society. Now, what does that actually mean? Does it mean that there is a independently owned and edited press? Not yet, but the blogosphere and the digital space and the public space is much more open and hard to control. And the feeling one gets in Cuba is just much less fear and self-censorship than once existed. Part of that has to do with the demographic reality of the country, and part of it has to do with the global environment in which Cuba lives. The world has changed, and Cuba's changing too. Political prisoners in Cuba were once in the 60s, 70s, 80s numbered in the thousands, You know, under Raul Castro, almost all of them, as far as I know, have now been released. Some of them, including allowed to leave the country, some not. You know, there are a kind of ambiguous counting of who is a political prisoner and who isn't. But the space that Cubans have to have a debate that is very lively right now about what kind of country they want to have, what does Cuba's future look like, is more free than I've ever seen it.
And when we talk about Cuba opening up, I mean, in the U.S., the memo that the Cold War was over got lost somewhere in the mailroom, but that hasn't been the case for other countries. What degree has it changed and transitioned economically without us? I mean, how much private property is there? How much have things opened up in that sense? How many Italian tourists are lounging around on the beach?
I think it's funny that you phrase that as changed without us, because, you know, that's a almost kind of a, it's a trope of the way we talk about Latin America. How can anything happen in Latin America without us? But
right.
But the truth is that without us, Cuba over the last 25 years opened itself to tourism. I mean, the numbers, not just Italians, Canadians, and now a couple of 100,000 Americans, and the numbers are going to grow. The numbers in 2015 topped 3.5 million. The projections are that it'll hit 5 million as the travel restrictions are loosened for Americans. But that's not the only measure of change. I mean, one of the things that's notable about Raul Castro is that he's just rewriting the social contract there. So the days are gone of everything being for free. The days are gone of depending upon the state for everything in the paycheck included. Something at least 500,000 Cubans have come off the state payrolls in the last 5 years, and maybe 400,000 to 500,000 licenses for small businesses has been issued. Private property is not regarded any longer as anathema and sort of the leading spear of imperialism. It's regarded, I mean, some people probably do view it as that in Cuba, but it's regarded as a necessary part of Cuba's economic future. Cuba's becoming a mixed economy. And I say becoming because it is, you know, it's not exactly half and half yet. But they've passed a new foreign investment bill. I think there's a political decision that Cuba, in order to take advantage of its very, very rich human capital, has to bring in foreign investments and is starting to slowly realize that it can do so without losing control. And that's the significance of the president's visit, I think, is in that context of economic change, of the privatization of the residential real estate market, of the proliferation of small businesses, slowly but palpably compared to when you were there, when I first went there, Obama now coming down there, and, you know, sort of finding the space for the two countries to coexist without regime change being part of the president's message at all.
Right, right. Now, so do you think that the country's vaunted education and healthcare systems are endangered in that sense? I mean, if you look into your crystal ball, does Cuba stay a social democracy, a nominally socialist country? Is there a chance that it shifts rightward and becomes Chile after the Castros pass away? They're not young spring chickens.
Right. Well, you know, when I get asked that question about what is the new Cuban model going to be, I think about a hybrid between sort of Scandinavia, Hialeah, and Cuba itself.
That is the best answer anybody's given me in a really long time.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm happy to hear that. And I mean, the Hialeah part of it is not obviously just Hialeah. It's the state of Florida. I mean, Cuba has 10% of its population living outside of the country, and most of them are in Florida. And the family and organic ties of capital and investment and just the flow back and forth are such that, you know, it's hard for me to imagine a Chile model, but, you know, Cuba's very much Cuban Americans and their money are investing in Cuba. Cubans on the island who are now beginning to make money are investing in South Florida. It's becoming a commuter economy. And so that, I mean, the word integration is sort of anathema and scary political term in the given Cuba's history. And I wouldn't say it's like full-blown economic integration that we're looking at yet, but the role of the United States and the South Florida and the Gulf state economy in Cuba in the future is an extremely important one. And I think it's going to combine with a very, very solid and coherent and still intact commitment in the Constitution and among the population to having as fair of a society as possible. Now, that might mean, to your question, do the educational and health systems suffer? Well, you know, they change. So far, still, Cuban health numbers and, you know, what Cubans die of and their longevity and all that is competes with Scandinavia.
Right.
So the social system is changing, but the fundamentals of what the revolution has delivered on that front, I think, you know, they will do their very, very best to keep those intact. And they're already changing, but I don't see any kind of full-out political rejection on the island at all of those essentials.
And I guess this is a related question. You know, Cuba is 90 miles south of Miami. It's not a virgin tourist destination by any means, but there's certainly a lot of room for expansion for U.S. tourism. We've only recently been able to go there without some cultural or social or educational reason. And it goes without saying that the embargo has caused a lot of economic pain for Cuba, and Cubans want to see that opening happen. But do you get the sense when you talk to them that they're worried about becoming Disneyfied or losing their culture if relations are fully normalized with the U.S.?
Well, you know, Cuba, one of the reasons that Cuba's cultural heritage and productivity and, you know, Cuba is a standout among all of Latin America because Cuba was the center of the Spanish crown in the 19th century, of the Spanish crown's colonial empire in the Americas. And its standing and it hasn't changed with revolution. In fact, it's gotten more so. And I mean, I might sound a little bit too optimistic here. I think there's some worried, you know, we talk about like, well, what about Starbucks and Walmart going there and corrupting that authentic Cuba that people want to preserve? You know, I think that at least the current sense I have is that Cubans are going to be very, very careful just because we change our law and they change our law to make commercial ties more possible. Doesn't mean that, you know, it's going to start looking like Puerto Rico anytime soon at all, or even South Florida. But, you know, down the road, 10, 20 years, I think there will be more of an American commercial presence there without a doubt, and that'll feel uncomfortable. But Cuba has enough serious professionals, urban planners, for example, talk about like the Malecón in Havana, who are not going to let it turn into another Miami.
If you're just tuning in, this is Politics and Reality Radio, and I'm speaking with Julia Swag about Cuba. So I think listeners have a pretty good idea of the political obstacles that exist here at home. We just heard Marco Rubio reject normalization unless basically they decide that they're going to be all American, basically. We have a handful of cold warriors on Capitol Hill. Is there an equivalent group of hardliners in the Cuban government pushing back against normalization?
I mean, I don't know about equivalent, but, you know, there are, I think in 2011, between 2011 and now, and I say 2011 because that was the last time they had a party congress, and they're going to have another one, the Communist Party Congress, next month, the political consensus around the value of normalization, economic and politically speaking, to Cuba being able to preserve what the founding revolutionary mamas and papas created, that political consensus was solidified. There are still, I would say that those who object to the normalization and see it as a threat are not in the top tier of the cabinet or the Politburo so much as they are within the bureaucracy, the people who for many, many years would be able to take advantage of what was a huge black market and protect their interests and steal from the state and, you know, keep themselves going and have small businesses on the side based on petty theft. And that this opening is a threat to that kind of mid-level bureaucrat for whom the status quo ante was kind of cushy. There are opinions that are expressed, I see them all the time in my in-mail, inbox, about, you know, certain kind of reticence and concern, but at the top level, this decision has been made.
Right. My final question before I let you go, there has long been tensions between the U.S. and the Latin American left with Venezuela, Bolivia, to a lesser degree, Brazil and Argentina and other countries. And it's been, relations have been strained by our history of military interventions and the drug war and a host of other issues. But Cuba has been a significant one of those issues. The embargo has been a significant issue. To what degree can you see normalizing relations between Washington and Havana having a kind of spillover effect into our broader relationship with Latin America?
Well, I mean, before Barack Obama undertook this initiative, I was among those people who were making exactly that case, that our policy toward the region and especially toward the left had been so filtered by our focus and obsession with preventing another Cuba and isolating Cuba that we sort of missed the reasons for the real reasons as opposed to Cuba's role for the appeal of left populist politics in the region, and that having the United States as isolated as it was in a region that was sort of center-left was bad for American interests, bad for American foreign policy, and could be easily remedied by moving the dial on Cuba, which the administration has now done. And, you know, I think it's actually taken a lot of the radioactivity out of Washington's standing in Latin America. Cuba's not the issue that Latin Americans can complain about. Now, you know, whether it's Bolivia or Venezuela, the specific nature of the bilateral relationship between the two countries is the focus of the issue as opposed to the stupidity of the Cold War policy toward Cuba, and I think that's very positive. And you saw it, you know, when Obama was in Panama for the Summit of the Americas almost a year ago, it was the first time I can remember in a very long time, I mean, it was an incredible moment to have Raul Castro and Obama sitting in the same conference table talking to each other. But, you know, even guys like Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela, they really didn't get much airtime, try as they might, to, you know, do the polarizing routine that he and Chavez had done so well with in the past. And that's because of this initiative. So I think it allows Latin America and Washington to talk to one another a little, quite a bit differently than we have pre-2014.
Julia Swag, I believe we're about out of time. Hey, I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Joshua. Thanks for having me.
Folks, stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then talk Supreme Court nominations with Martin Longman.
Won't somebody please help me with my misery? Can somebody see?
Welcome back to the show. I'm joined now by Martin Longman. Martin is the web editor for the Washington Monthly, so I really appreciate him taking the time to speak with me because they have to churn out a ton of work over there, and they're not putting up cat videos. Martin also runs the Progressive Pond, which I will always think of as Boo Man Tribune. Martin, thanks for joining us today.
How you doing, Josh?
I'm well. So Obama has nominated a 63-year-old centrist white guy named Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. He did so as Senate Republicans have vowed to not even entertain a nominee from this president. They said they're not going to talk to him. They're not going to have hearings. They're not going to have a vote for him. They've cited all sorts of kind of ridiculous fake precedents for an unprecedented act of obstruction. But a lot of liberals are unhappy with the pick, and they think that Obama could have gone with a younger, more liberal justice, and a lot of them would have liked to have seen a woman, perhaps, or a person of color. You take a little bit of a different view on this. What is your take on this?
Well, I think that the number one thing is that Barack Obama was given advance notice that anybody he picked, that they were going to refuse to meet with them or have a hearing or have a vote. So his option was to accept that or to try to break that resistance. So one of the things is that you would make it easier for them to obstruct if you put somebody up there who had judicial views that were obviously, I mean, that were transparently to the left, so that, say, the progressive left was happy, right? They would see the same things that the Republicans saw, and the Republicans would then be able to say, we're in control of the Senate. We're not going to replace Scalia with someone to the far left. And they'd be able to make an argument that picking someone out of the mainstream would dramatically shift the court, and that they weren't going to be a party to that because they had enough control to prevent it. And that argument would float a lot better than the argument they're left with now, because Merrick Garland is somebody that they like. They're on the record as liking him. They're on the record as recommending him. So they can't argue that there's a problem with the justice. They can only say they just don't feel like doing this. And that puts the president in a better position. It puts the senators that are up for re-election in a more vulnerable position. And it makes it more possible to break their resistance.
So Garland is the candidate that exacts maximum political pain for Republican obstruction. I would also add to that, if Obama were to be successful, and the pressure that the administration and also outside groups are putting on Republicans was to lead them to confirm Garland, he would push the court significantly to the left as a replacement for Antonin Scalia. So he's not like an awful pick. It would be a huge shift on the court. And then if the Democratic nominee wins in November, he or she will in all likelihood have a shot at replacing Anthony Kennedy, who's pushing 80, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is over 80. Martin, I agree with you on this, by the way, but there's a counter argument that we need to consider. Lawrence Baum and Neil Devins wrote this week for Slate that Garland is ideologically similar to Elena Kagan, who was not nominated in this kind of circumstance. And I want to read an excerpt from what they wrote and get your reaction, because Obama's decision to not kind of precipitate a battle over an ideological battle seems to be consistent with Democrats. They wrote, and I quote, "Democrats Bill Clinton and Barack Obama veered away from candidates whose strong liberalism would prompt confirmation battles and towards nominees who embraced the rhetoric of judicial restraint, had rich personal histories, and were perceived as less ideological. In contrast," and they did a study on this, "in contrast, Republican presidents in the current era have generally not chosen to compromise by appointing moderates to the court One reason is that members of conservative legal groups, such as the Federalist Society, play a key role in shaping legal policy in Republican administration. So let's step back. Republicans get a lot of pressure from outside groups to nominate right-wing judges or more conservative judges, while Democrats do not. Martin, in that context, shouldn't we, as outside progressives, bring similar pressure to bear to get really liberal justices? Or is it the case that it doesn't matter as much because the law itself kind of has a liberal bias in many ways, and we benefit from having a straight umpire?
Well, that's a great question. And I
thought it was a good question, too.
and I think there, a lot of things occurred to me while you were talking. And one is, the first thing that came to my mind was to question the premise just a little bit, which is part of the reason the Republicans are so hard-ass about having a conservative justice is because they've been burned. They thought that Anthony Kennedy and David Souter were going to overturn Roe v. Wade in the Casey case, and they along with O'Connor and John Paul Stevens, they were all nominated by Republicans, and they all voted to uphold Roe. And so you have that. Then you have, remember, Bush tried to put Harriet Myers on the court, and no one knew where she stood on Roe. You know, the Republicans revolted against that idea for a variety of reasons, but among them that they didn't know where she stood on Roe. They have a mission to use the courts to overturn existing law, and they've been on this march for a long time, and so that they're always going to be trying to pick people who aren't going to follow precedent, right? And I think that got to your last point, a straight umpire or a liberal bias to the law. I mean, if what we want is to uphold the law, that, you know, that's different than having someone come in and completely overturn it. So
I think that's a good answer to my good question.
Yeah. But the other question was, what should progressives do, right? And I'm doing this election as kind of a straight analyst, so I'm not taking a side in the Sanders-Clinton war. In the past, I've been much more of a advocate and an organizer. So I think there is a role for progressives to mirror what conservatives do and make maximalist demands and you know, not really be reasonable or realistic or whatever. It just annoys me when they go from that to really harsh rhetoric around the people who actually have to make these decisions.
I think that's absolutely right. One thing that makes me crazy is this tendency among progressives, some progressives in the activist community, to not fully appreciate all of the kind of veto points set into our system that makes it very hard to take maximalist positions and actually get them, achieve those positions. Let me get a couple of predictions from you before I let you go. I don't like making predictions, but you're a pretty good forecaster. How does this play out? Do Republicans cave? And if they don't cave before the election and Hillary Clinton wins in November, do they confirm Garland in order to avoid a more liberal or at least a younger pick next year?
I think that, in part, this is an example of progressives wanting to say one thing, but the truth being a slightly different. I think that Garland is already basically pre-approved by the Republicans in the Senate. I think that there were articles to that effect that Obama had talked to them and that they would approve him in the lame duck session, provided Hillary wins. And I also think that Hillary would renominate him. And I think he probably has assurances to all of that, or he probably wouldn't have accepted the nomination. So I don't think that the threat that there will be a more progressive younger candidate is actually real. But it's at least something to throw out there, because it intimidates the right and gives them a reason to fold on this, because actually the deal they've got on the table is a good deal.
Right. They do like him. I mean, they don't think of him as the worst possible outcome for a Democratic nominee. Now, one final question. Josh Marshall thinks that the GOP's refusal to even hold hearings is going to hurt them badly. And his basic argument is that, you know, strong partisans on both sides won't be moved by any of this. We are set in our ways. But he sees low information voters in the middle, you know, people who may not care about the ideological tilt of the court itself. He sees those people as being very receptive to the message that these senators aren't doing their jobs. And I'm not sure. I think it could feed into kind of the lazy narrative that both sides are to blame for Washington's dysfunction. What's your view of the potency of this in terms of those Senate races that that might or might not hang in the balance?
I think that the senators that are in blue states are vulnerable on this issue. And I think that Josh Marshall is correct, that it will have saliency in the middle among low-information voters who will see this as totally unreasonable. But you have to understand why the Republicans are doing this. There's two reasons. One is that there's this long-shot Hail Mary that they'll actually win the election and get to pick their own replacement to Scalia. But the second reason is because if they cave now, it will feed into everything that the Republican base is furious about, which is that they won't fight, that they cave into Obama, to give him everything he wants. Obama always wins. And if the Supreme Court is extremely important to the Republican base, more so than the Democratic base. And so it will cause massive demoralization if they confirm Garland before the election in their base. So on the one hand, they're trying to keep turnout from collapsing. They already have a base in complete revolt against the establishment. And they're trying to prevent a complete collapse. So that is a huge reason why this is happening. And they're not completely wrong about that. So it's a trade-off, and it depends on what district you're in or what state you're in, how that balances out. I don't think it's going to be the same in every case. Some places, they need max turnout to win a congressional district, say. But in another state, they might need to get some crossover votes to hold on to a Senate seat in a blue state. So there's not anything clean here. There's a cost no matter how they go.
They're caught between a rock and a hard place. Right. But the thing is that they need to maintain a united front to make this work. If some of them say, oh, well, I'll meet with him, I'll consider voting for him, it undermines really their whole message that it's not about the candidate or it's not about the nominee. It's about, quote unquote, giving the choice to the voters. Martin Longman, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Great. My pleasure, Josh.
I'd also like to thank David Kate Johnston and Julia Swag. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L. And you can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show on Podbean or iTunes. Of course, I want to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.